Let me tell you first who I am. I am the editor of a magazine called Multinational Monitor. Copies in the back, if you can pick them up, that are related to corporate concentration issues, distinct from the others that I hope you've been able to pick up today. We have a promo sheet here, so you can subscribe. And if you're desperate, you can subscribe right now and give me the form before we go. You get a special discount subscription. On the back, we give you a promotion for a book that I'm co-author of called Corporate Predators. Those are on sale, and by Laughing Horse Book. If you want information on that, on the book, that's my first website here, corporatepredators.org. That the book is a compilation of columns that I do with a colleague named Russell Hochheimer, and those columns are distributed electronically. If you're interested in signing for weekly listserv, you can send out those columns. Click on that website and go. Let me start by just asking, how many people know who Joel Klein is? How about Bob Thompson? Okay. Those are the two leading antitrust enforcement agents in the U.S. government. Joel Klein works for Janet Reno. He's the head of the antitrust division at the Justice Department. And Robert Potofsky is the head of the Federal Trade Commission. They share dual responsibility for enforcement of antitrust laws, and we'll get into a little bit later how it is that they work and what it is that they do and how it is that we in the room and we collectively in the movement may try to influence them and their associates. My sense from the fact that no one else was placed on this panel with me is that people in the anti-corporate world don't generally talk about antitrust. That's not just my sense of this conference. I do a lot of work in a lot of different spheres, and I know that the number of people who think about antitrust in a systematic way is small. And I think that's a mistake, but it's not a mistake because I want people to jump onto an issue that I'm concerned about, although that's true. I think it's a mistake because people who are working on corporate-related issues generally understand that corporate size matters. In fact, we heard that Norman Solomon was talking about it today in the plenary about media corporations. I was at an earlier workshop on biotechnology. People were talking about corporate concentration in the biotech area, Monsanto buying up seed companies and so on. These are observations that are important, but they need to be viewed, at least in part, through the prism of antitrust. Because if we don't, we don't have any real practical solutions for dealing with the issues. Now, partly, of course, they have to be dealt with as political questions, maybe mostly political questions. And that doesn't really require thinking about it in terms of antitrust. But the tool that deals with concentrated corporate power is antitrust. So what I want to do talk about today is a little bit about the history of antitrust, explain what's going on right now with mergers and corporate concentration, and talk about some of the specific harms and try to elaborate them in precise ways. If we have the time to do that, I'm not going to be too rhetorical in this talk. And then talk about how it is that antitrust can be influenced by progressive activists. The first thing to say is that the United States now and the world is in the midst of the greatest merger wave in the history, in history of the United States and history of the world. Last year, according to the Federal Trade Commission, if you want more on this, you can go to www.ftc.gov. There's actually quite a bit of very useful information there. Last year, there were a little over 4,700 mergers that were reported to the Federal Trade Commission. Those are only large mergers that are reported involving two companies, one of over $100 million and one of over $10 million. So those are big mergers, 4,700 of those. That was a 28% increase from the previous year's record, 1997, 3,700. It was a 200% increase from just over 1,500 at the beginning of the decade, 1991. So there's merger way of life. Nothing has ever been seen before in the United States. Come on in, Dylan. Here's a list of the largest mergers in the history of the world, dating through March. I think this list is no longer correct. Sorry. But you'll notice something interesting when I read you the dates of all these mergers. Number 10, at least as of March 99, was Daimler-Benz buying Chrysler. That was May 1998, $40 billion. Number 9 was WorldCom buying MCI. That was October 1997, for a value of $43 billion. Number 8 was Vodafone buying AirTouch Communications in January of this year. That was $55 billion. 7 was British Petroleum buying Amoco, $55 billion in August 98. Number 6 was AT&T buying TCI in June 98 for $57 billion. Number 5 was Nations Bank buying Bank of America in April 98 for $61 billion. Number 4 was Bell Atlantic acquisition of GTE in July 98 for $71 billion. Oops, list is wrong. That's number 3. Number 4 was SBC buying Ameritech for $61 billion in May 98. Number 2 was the Citicorp Travelers merger, which is worth $72 billion. And topping it off was the revitalization of the Standard Oil monopoly, Exxon buying Mobil, in December 98 for over $75 billion. Those are huge corporate acquisitions. You might have noticed something interesting about the dates. They all took place in the last 2.5 years. So the 10 biggest mergers ever all took place in the last 2.5 years. This is a serious thing going on. It's totally unprecedented. You haven't noticed an unprecedented wave of antitrust enforcement that's going along without any considerable interference from the government, with a handful of minor and mostly trivial exceptions. So it doesn't matter, what can we do about it? Let's talk about that.
When you say that's the biggest industry, are you adjusting the money for like the 30s or the 20s or something?
That's a good point. No, I'm not. I'm not, and there may be a couple that have graded in. I just saw a number on the mergers that created U.S. Steel at the turn of the century. And I can't remember how big that is in present day dollars. It might make a list, but I'm not sure it does. But that's a good transition. If we had had a meeting like this 100 years ago, it would have been not called in corporate dominance. It would have been a populist agrarian movement meeting, probably. And antitrust would have been at the center of what was being talked about. It was really the core issue that motivated the most powerful, significant anti-corporate movement in our nation's history, which was the populist movement throughout the Midwest. The farmers talked about railroad monopolies. Urban reformers talked about trusts in oil, sugar, tobacco, a variety of other areas. The popular agitation around this stuff led to the passage of a series of antitrust laws, which remained the dominant framework for antitrust enforcement in the United States now. In 1890, there was something passed called the Sherman Act. Then in 1914 was the Clayton Act, which is a much more powerful piece of legislation, and also the Federal Trade Act, Federal Trade Commission Act. And those three laws established the ongoing framework for antitrust enforcement. It gave government the power to stop, well, to do a couple things. One was to go after monopolies. And they don't do that very often, but that is what's going on now with the Microsoft case, for example, which is the best thing the government is currently doing in this area. So where there's a monopoly and a corporation misuses its monopoly power, not just having monopoly power, but misusing monopoly power, the government can go after them and seek a variety of remedies, including breaking up the company, which is what was done with the Standard Oil monopoly that then created most of the big existing oil companies. This set of laws also gives the government power to stop, or at least sue to stop, mergers that it thinks will have anti-competitive effects. And that's very important. That's the most important thing that the government does now in the area of corporate concentration, and it's what I'll be focusing on primarily. And then there's also a variety of criminal things that the laws ban, for example, price fixing. So competitors are not allowed to set prices for the most part. In the early 1900s, this was front and center of antitrust laws, of political debate. And so Roosevelt had this reputation as the great trust buster. There was actually more antitrust activity after Roosevelt left office. And it was a core issue. It was like having Bill Clinton, debate antitrust policy with Bob Dole. I don't remember that happened. But that was what was going on 100 years ago. It was that central to the understanding was that central to the popular movement that was forced on the agenda really by the populist and progressive movement. And they talked a little bit about some of the things that are the primary focus now. They talked about the harms to consumers and how concentrated corporate power leads to higher prices and consumers getting ripped off in a variety of ways. They talked a lot about how farmers were getting ripped off by railroads. But they primarily talked about the political consequences of corporate power, which is totally absent from the debate now. They understood that big corporations exercise a stranglehold over policymaking, that's unacceptable, and the solution is to say, no big corporations. And one of my themes is that we need to recapture that essence. By the 1940s, it was pretty well understood that when you had a concentrated market, a handful of major players, that there was a serious problem of them colluding. And there were a variety of cases where the government found large companies colluding with each other, dividing up markets, price fixing. They found secret meetings, for example, between competitors like GE and Westinghouse, where they plotted out exactly how they were going to divide markets. Those things still go on, as we'll discuss in a minute, as you might have read recently in the headlines. Antitrust enforcement even remained vigorous through the 50s and 60s and 70s. And it wasn't perfect, but it was pretty serious. And it was a real impediment. And all of the mergers that I read off that list, without exception, would have been impossible to imagine. They would not have been stopped. They never would have been proposed, because they would have been seen as stupid. It was ridiculous to think that Exxon and Mobil could merge. The number one and number two oil company, no one would possibly permit such a thing to take place. Because common sense says that's a dumb thing to do. We don't want that much concentrated power. But something really important happened in the 1970s, and it shifted things in antitrust, which is pretty instrumental for us thinking about what we might do. People know who Milton Friedman is. You have to know, because he's been tied here. Maybe I need Joel Klein to be tied in evidence of Joel Klein. Milton Friedman was at the University of Chicago. He's an economist. He has a total free market, not so serious. Free markets are everything. Don't ever interfere with free markets. That notion took hold also at the University of Chicago Law School. And so in the field of law, they developed a set of ideas known as the Chicago School. And this had ramifications throughout the law. And there's a whole series of retrograde things that happened in the legal profession, among in the judiciary, and even in legislative processes as a result of the Chicago School influence. But they had their greatest effect in the area of antitrust, which is kind of logical. The basic notion of the Chicago School is that economics thinking should be infused into law. That the highest, in fact, the only serious value that should be considered in antitrust policy, or a criminal justice policy, or a constitutional rights policy, is economic efficiency. Whatever is efficient, that's what should go. Well, that, out of all the places that it might land, that makes most sense, or at least fits best, in antitrust, which has to do with how we structure business relationships. So it took hold most effectively in antitrust. There were two, it's pretty elaborate how they work all of that, but there were two really core effects of the law and economics of the Chicago School, also known as law and economics. They had two major influences over antitrust thinking. The first was to wipe out the idea that there should be any political content. Please come on in. That there should be any political content to antitrust. I like this from my perspective. The left side of the room is totally mean. The first notion was forget politics. Antitrust is about efficiency only. All this old stuff, people worried about railroads, farms, whatever. That was either stupid or dated. Actually, I just said it was stupid. It was wrong. And that's dated. We need to be serious, hard-headed people. What we want are efficient markets. How do we get efficient markets? antitrust doesn't have anything to say about that, antitrust should shut up. The second thing they said was that they succeeded in imposing on antitrust law was the concept that economic theory, what they could work out in clever either mathematical equations or interesting explanations, mattered more than practical experience. So where it was possible to show that something was theoretically impossible, it was, and for the law, it must be impossible, even if we could see that it exists in the real world. So for example, there's something called predatory pricing, which is illegal under the antitrust law. That's where a large corporation, along with big market share, has market power, prices its goods below its actual cost to drive out competitors, and then with the idea that it'll have monopoly and can raise prices however it chooses. That was Standard Oil Trust was famous for that. They would lower the prices, drive out competitors, buy them up, or drive them to bankruptcy. Then they would raise prices where they took monopoly control. Well, the Chicago school said that can't happen. That's irrational. No one would do that. And therefore, it doesn't happen. Except that it does. There are plenty of examples, important examples, where it does happen, including with Microsoft and a variety of concepts. So they invented this theory. Well, a lot of people invent theories, including a fair number of progressive people in law schools. They don't usually take hold. These guys, though, were successful. They weren't just theorists. They were activists. And they were effective activists. And they were also effective activists backed by powerful money and interest. And they got huge foundation, huge right-wing foundation funding from things called the Olin Foundation, the Gates Foundation, and a handful of others. They held seminars. They educated other law professionals on how this should work. They sort of sold their theory successfully. They held training seminars for the federal judiciary, so for federal judges, at George Mason University and a university in Florida, which I forget. And something like two-thirds of the federal judiciary has gone through these seminars. In most cases, that wouldn't be a big deal because federal judges are serious people and they have relatively well thought out ideas about how the law works. But in the area of antitrust, kind of fuzzy, feeling more like economics, and there's like constitutional law or something like law, maybe they're not so sure how it works, and so there's much more likelihood of them deferring to expert advice. And in fact, they have deferred to expert advice, and the law and economics perspective took hold in the federal judiciary. When Reagan got elected, it took over the Justice Department, and it's basically become the law. So in the course of about 15 years, they transformed, the Chicago School transformed antitrust law, which is a remarkable accomplishment. And it's only edged back, as I'll explain in a few minutes, a little bit under the Clinton administration. But the basic framework has been completely redone. Now a Chicago School law and economics framework. Efficiency is the goal above all, positive spending out of it. With that, let me pause. Is all that clear? Any questions? All right, I'll keep going.
I have a question with the
yes. And it's different, actually, because it's a ripple effect from the same Chicago School of Economics. So the Chicago boys were in the economics department of Chile and went down and did the video of the economy that was not just a model of the United States. And some of the influence of the economics department sort of wafted over to the law school and took hold of it. So it's one center, but two different directions where they had.
I would say it's not a phenomenon restricted to law, or something happened in the early 70s. This was a remarkable constellation of things that began in the early 70s, including deviation of profits from productivity from wage gains, freezing of wages, the reduction of corporate taxes. There's a whole constellation of events that began around that time. It's always been interesting just why and what happened.
I think that's right. And that's, there's certainly a political context, which all this, what you're referring to, called shape. And it wouldn't have been possible for the Chicago School to succeed. They didn't just succeed because they had money and they had a coherent theory. There was a political moment where they could succeed. There's no question about that.
Question.
Yes, I'm sorry.
About when did that 15-year period start? Or how did it
sort of early 70s, was the incipiency of it? I guess it's less than that. Really. So it started in the early 70s, and by the time Reagan came in, they won. And it's, you know, it's an ongoing process, and it's not absolute. I'm giving it slightly more black and white than it happened, but not too much. So what I wanted to do was talk a little bit about some of the particulars of antitrust law and how it works. And this is sort of a prelude to thinking about real concrete effects, harmful effects of this. But part of, I think, what's required, and I'm taking advantage of our time, but I think part of what we need to do to be effective about this is to understand the terms on which these issues are understood at the antitrust enforcement agencies. Some of this stuff is slightly technical, but I think it's pretty, I'll make it understandable. And if I don't, stop. So again, to just go over what I mentioned earlier, the antitrust laws do not make monopolies illegal. So you can become a monopoly legally. The question is, first of all, how you became a monopoly, and second of all, do you leverage your market power in ways that give you further competitive advantage? Companies are understood to have market power where they can charge more than what a competitive market would allow. So, for example, if there was a local drugstore, if such a thing exists anymore, it would not have market power because it would have the CVS that's down the street, and it knows that it can't raise the price of Crest too high, or CVS is going to undersell it, and it's going to go out of business. Maybe it did go out of business. Conversely, if there are only three oil companies or three gas station companies in the town, it may be that a company can raise its price 3 or 4 cents above what the competitors are charging and still maintain its business. If that's the case, then it has market power. And at some point, you know, if they had 90% of the market, they definitely could do that. So then there are some things that are under the antitrust law that are per se illegal. So price fixing is illegal. You can't form formal cartel, that's illegal. You can't get together deciding to divide up markets and customers and set prices. Conspiracies to restrain trade are illegal. And those things are those are always illegal. They're what's called per se illegal. They're illegal under any circumstance. But the main thing to think about, there's two kinds of broader issues. One, when in the context of mergers. One is vertical mergers and one is horizontal mergers. So vertical mergers are between, say, a supplier and a supplier. So if take an example of what? If steel is a good one. So if a steel company bought the inputs, the mineral inputs, the iron companies, that would be supplier, the vertical kind of combination. A horizontal combination is between two competitors in the same consumer market. So two oil companies merging, for example, or two tobacco companies merging is a horizontal merger. The vertical mergers are a little bit less important for a variety of reasons. They're not taking place as much as they once did. So most of the focus now when it comes to looking at these horizontal mergers, when it comes to looking at mergers, is with horizontal mergers.
Was the mergers in the lifetime industry considered vertical, or is there like buying up seeds and then selling them to fertilizer? And would that be considered vertical?
They would be both. And the way you're describing it, that's right, they are vertical. The other way that they're horizontal is, of course, that Monsanto already had, for example. And each time they buy a new seed company, there's this horizontal issue of how it affects them in the seed market. And the way they, I think this is worth doing. The way the antitrust authorities look at horizontal mergers is they apply something called the HHI index, which stands for Perpendicular-Hirschman index, which is totally unimportant for you. And what they do is they look at the market share of all the major competitors before the merger and after the merger. They take the market share of all of the pre-merger market of each individual company, and they square it. Okay? And they add up all the squares. And they say, what would it be in the post-merger market? They square all the individual companies, they add it up, and then they compare the two. To give you an example, if there were Let's say there were, let's say there's 10 companies in a market that have, that each have 10% market share. Okay, so there's 10 of these. And then after a merger, there's one company that's going to have 20% market share, and there's going to be eight that have 10% market share, right? So we have 20. And so then they say, well, look, we're going to square all of these, so 10 times 10 equals 100. There's 10 of these for a total of 1,000. Here they take this one, the top one, right, it's 400. When they calculate the square, they square all of these, this is 10 times 10 equals 100. There's 8 of these, so when you add up the total here, it's 1,200. Okay? That's pretty clear, right? Okay. So then they say, well, it goes from 1,000 to 1,200. And they have a whole scheme where they say, well, 1,000 means they're starting out at moderately concentrated. And if it's below 1,000, it's low concentrated. If it's above 1,500 or something, it's highly concentrated. They say, well, we're taking a jump in a moderately concentrated market of 200. Well, that's a modest jump according to this chart. And therefore, they would say, well, presumptively, this merger is okay. And if the number was bigger, if it started out at, say, 2,000 and it went up to 3,000, that would mean they were starting out, according to the system, in a highly concentrated market, and it took a big jump to make it more anti-competitive. And they would say, well, this is presumptively not okay. Is this clear? Okay. So that's the basic scheme. And they don't always follow it, and it turns out in the last couple of years they've made a number of exceptions to that. Where they say, I don't know of any cases where they say, even though it would look like it's not that big a deal, we're going to challenge it. But there are a lot of cases where they blow the system out of the water, and they say it's going to go through anyway. Now, when they do this, it's not so easy to come up with this market share, because they're very complicated questions about how you define the market. And there's two different ways that you have to argue about what the market is. And when you're actually arguing this issue and trying to sort of communicating with people who are antitrust enforcement people, which is both the federal government and the state government, which is something I should mention and we'll return to, you need to understand this. So one way they talk about it is the geographic market. So we might say two big oil companies are merging, say Exxon and Mobil. And let's pretend that Exxon only exists, only has gas stations east of the Mississippi, and Mobil only has gas stations west of the Mississippi. Well, I might say, look, that's the number one and number two oil companies, and you guys are nuts if you let that go through. They would say, actually, they don't compete at all. As it is right now, Exxon and Mobil don't compete. So if they become one company, there's no loss of competition whatsoever because they're in different geographic markets. Now, there's an answer to that, which is, well, maybe they're potential competitors. And the antitrust authorities pay attention to that. But basically, the presumption would be that they're not competitors. The other thing is the product. So one area is the geographic market, and the other area is,
The Federal Trade Commission, is that the regulatory agency that you're talking about that's doing all this controlling?
It's the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department, Antitrust Division.
And who makes the appointments to these boards?
The Department of Justice, the head of the Antitrust Division is appointed as a political appointment by the President, which has to be confirmed by the Senate, and the Federal Trade Commission is supposed to be an independent agency, which is also appointed by the President with confirmation, but it doesn't have the same responsibility to the President that the head of the Antitrust Division does. And if you actually are interested in this, I piqued your interest for some reason for this business, you get the full antitrust guidelines on the Department of Justice webpage, which is usdoj.gov. Scroll around and you can find the answer. They're called the antitrust guidelines, and they explain how this works in quite a lot of detail. But it's very understandable. So if you're interested in this, it's quite a useful thing to look at. So one area that you have to look at in trying to define the market is the geographic market. The other issue is the product market. And the question is whether, for example, if a coffee and a tea company merge, are they really part of the same hot beverage market? Or are they really two different companies working in two separate markets, the coffee and the tea market? And so you have arguments about this stuff. And industry tends to do pretty well because they hire lots of expensive lawyers and expensive economists to make their case. When it comes to the mergers, a lot is done by the antitrust enforcement agencies, but final decisions are made by the judiciary, by the judges. And there's still the basic framework of law is set still by these three statutes that I mentioned that were passed in 1890 and 1914, and they haven't been modified in any significant ways. So most of how these decisions are made is based on case law. In other words, judges have made law over the course of almost 100 years now that elaborate on this stuff. So judges are very important in the whole system. So as we close this issue of how the antitrust laws work, let me just comment on a few overriding principles in this stuff. One is that the antitrust law inherently requires a lot of flexibility because these are all unique situations that come up with each merger. But the U.S. law has an enormous amount of flexibility because the laws, you get these three old laws, and you have a lot of power that ends up going to judges. The second point is that there's administrative enforcement by the two antitrust enforcement agencies. There's also private enforcement. So if you've been the victim of an antitrust violation, you can file suit in the court as a victim and run your case. And you can't really do it as a consumer victim. You have to pretty much be a business competitor victim, which is a problem, probably for most people in this room. And is actually quite a serious problem in the law. A third point is that there's overlapping state and federal authority in this area. So the federal government has a role, as I've been describing, but almost every state government has the same role. And the attorney general is then the key enforcement official in the state. And there's probably an Oregon, for example, I don't know the Oregon AG situation. There's probably an antitrust enforcement agency within the attorney general. And so when you have some of the big bank mergers, for example, have taken place in Oregon, or Enron buying the utility company here, the state AG has got, the attorney general has to sign up on those mergers as well as the federal government. So you've got the prospect of pressuring a local official or a state official who's going to be much more susceptible to lobbying or political pressure than the federal officials are likely to be. A fourth point is about remedies. The remedies for a federal action or government action is they can stop a merger, or criminal actions are fined. But in the private cases, there's triple damages. So if you can show you were hurt to the tune of $100 million, you get $300 million rewarded. So there should be quite a big incentive to bring these kinds of cases. But the downside is they're almost impossible to win now because of the effect of the Chicago School, and no one does despite the incentive.
I didn't quite understand. You said that it's okay to have a monopoly. There's no problem with that. But now you're talking about restricting mergers, which is the generation of monopoly. I don't quite understand. I thought you said it was okay to have a monopoly.
That's right.
But now you're talking about the Trust Department looking at mergers.
You're right. That's exactly right. The answer is that they look at you, even though it's okay to have a monopoly if you get it by acceptable means. In other words, if you grow to be a monopoly through your natural sales of, say, an innovative product that nobody can match. What's unacceptable is either to use your monopoly power illegitimately, according to the laws, or to have a merger that will tend to reduce competition. And if they think that the merger will take you towards more, will give you market power, they theoretically will stop it. Let's turn a little bit to what's going on now, which is probably a slightly more interesting issue. There have been two sets of recent mergers that at least some of the people in the room are going to be quite familiar with. One is the 1980 set of mergers, which were known as slash and burn. Actually, everybody here should be, because you all know about the Maxam merger, right? And taking over Pacific Lumber and all that stuff. That was a 1980 style merger where you had the corporate raider come in and take over a company involuntarily against a local seller who didn't really want to sell, build up huge debt. You guys probably know the story much better than I do. Or if you saw the movie Wall Street, that was fairly accurate for how things work, or how things did work. The 1990s mergers are a little bit different than that. Actually, they're quite a bit different than that. Most of them have been friendly, or at least relatively friendly. They haven't been based on debt. They've been based on the fact that companies' stock values have gone up so high that they've got effectively free money. They can trade their super evaluated stock to the shareholders of another company, buy that company, for no effective cost to the acquiring company. And that's how it's been done. All the talk now is not so much about the downsizing, well, there's still a considerable amount of that, or doing the kind of things that Maxim does. It's more now about efficiencies and economies of scale. Those are the buzzwords. Every merger, they say, will create a new merged entity that will have synergies, that will do new exciting things, that will take advantage of new possibilities. In fact, I think there's a huge fad element in this. And the CEOs actually get jealous of other CEOs who merge. kind of like merger envy. So, it's like this crazy thing. There's one merger in an industry, and everybody says there's going to be more mergers, and there are going to be more mergers, and it's not because of any objective, usually because of any objective economic fact affecting that industry, because they all think they have to be big to compete, which is untrue, or they just want to be big because they don't want to be smaller than the new big guy on the block. There are other factors that contribute substantially, like the fact that CEOs tend to make a lot of money in these things, and that the investment bankers who put the deals together get outrageous amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it's fair to say that as a general matter, the biggest mergers do almost nothing to make companies more efficient. There may be some exceptions to that.
Do you know anybody that
What's happened is that the stock, as you know, you can't avoid, if you're in contact with the mass media, you can't avoid it, the stock market has risen to a new height, right? We're now at 11,000, it's a glorious period. So, on the down. The effect of that, if you had a company that was trading at 50, for example, each share was trading at 50 a year ago, and now it's trading at 80, you know, the value of your company has increased 60%, probably because nothing has changed in your company, just because the market's gone up. So you've got like, where you've got money. You're rich now. And so what they do is the company that went up to 80 says to another company, here, we'll give you our stock. It's really worth a lot of money. And that the stock is effectively like money. And that was more money than it was a year ago. They're able to buy the company they acquired. They don't have to go to the bank. They basically trade the inflated value of the inflated stock they have. Okay, so what's going on? How does all this stuff matter? Well, there still are these employment effects. It still is the case that when you've got these big mergers, the companies tend to fire lots of people. There's my list of fires.
Well, how do the investment bankers get involved in this then if they don't need to go to a bank? I mean, for the balance.
The investment bankers are different than bankers. The investment bankers are the ones who put the deals together.
Okay.
In the old days, they tended not to go so much to bankers. They also went to investment bankers, but they took out
huge loans.
Right. And they floated bonds. That was the junk bond stuff. That was Michael Moore deal. So some of the recent cuts from job cuts from mergers, the BPM&Co merger is going to cost almost 6,000 jobs. The Citicorp Travelers merger was first going to cost 8,000 jobs, then it was supposed to go to 10,000. MCI WorldCom was 1,900. A bank merger, Fleet and Bank Boston was going to cost 5,000 jobs, which is 8% of the total workers at those two banks. So there's still pretty substantial job cuts that come as a result of this stuff. But the bigger effects come in the area of consumers and on the shape of markets and in a variety of ways that the economy is shaped as a result of the mergers. So the first thing is that consumers pay more when you have merged companies or you've got monopoly power. In the part of the country where I come from, we had Bell Atlantic and 9X merged. That was two of the baby bells. It was pretty, there were actually internal memos that said that if they had not merged, they would have started competing with each other. So in Washington, D.C., we might actually have had, someday soon, two local providers to choose from. No one doubts that would dramatically reduce the price of local phone provision. And out here in the West, there's been the mergers of SBC and Pacific Bell. Now there's the merger of SBC and Ameritech. And in each case, you lose the possibility that you want, that you would have had competition in the phone market. So the price of a phone call, of local phone calls, would have gone down. They're not going to. In the area of banking, I understand you've had a whole series of bank mergers that, that hit this region recently. The big banks, you're going to find, if you haven't already, if you're part of the big banks, not for credit union or something, that the bank fees go up. Bank fees go up with big banks. Even they're supposed to be more efficient. They need to charge more. On average, they charge 15% more for in bank fees than do smaller banks. Or we were involved in a merger of office superstores. So like Staples, Office Depot, Office Max. They have one of those out here. And Staples wanted to buy Office Depot. We helped stop that. The Federal Trade Commission, we just studied this in the Federal Trade Commission, pretty much more elaborate study. They found that Staples, there's only three major companies now. So where there was no competition, Staples charged 13% more on all its products than it did where there were two competitors. And where there was one competitor, they charged 5% more than they did in no competitor products. We did a survey on this, and we found that if you called in Staples, you can get a phone order, right? Instead of going to the store, you can get it delivered to you. They asked you what your zip code was, and they discriminated in pricing to you based on whether you would have had competition if you'd gone to your local store. Well, I don't know what the airline shuttles are like here on the West Coast, but on the East Coast, there's one that goes between New York and Washington. And the price is, it's often more expensive to go to the New York-Washington route than it is to go to New York-London. And I assume it's the same here. So you get this outrageous, just straight ahead, price impact, and I think as an organizing issue, that's the thing that hits people most clearly. It's going to happen in these oil industry mergers too. Yeah.
Is it just a coincidence that the great idea to privatize the phone services and the airlines and all this popped up just, you know, I think before all this merger stuff started happening, is that like apples and oranges or?
No, it would be like apples and apples. They weren't actually privatized. Of course, we didn't have state-owned telephone companies or airlines. They were deregulated. And part of the deregulation was supposed to, the deal was prices had more or less been set in the prior period, and that the price restraints were going to be lifted. Well, the way you could justify that is on the grounds that you're going to have competition, and the competition would moderate prices. But instead of getting competition, we got mergers. So we got the worst of all worlds. You also tend to have more price fixing where you've got fewer competitors because it's easier for companies to coordinate things. So the U.S. tobacco companies, which are now down to three major companies, have in three occasions in the last 2 years have raised prices by the exact same amount in 24 hours. Pretty remarkable coincidence and decision making. Toys R Us has used its market power to raise prices. There have been recent price cases brought against chemical companies, fax paper producers, denture makers, many others, and vitamins, as you probably all know. You all know that this is the vitamin case. There's total price fixing among, I think, like five worldwide, I'm not sure it's five or three, worldwide vitamin producers. And they've divided markets and customers. They said, who's going to get this customer, who's going to get that one? Not just individuals like you can go to the grocery store and buy vitamins, but like Kellogg's, which was, you know, vitamins and minerals and all this cereal. And they paid a $750 million fine, which was disparaged in an earlier meeting. In a sense, it deserves to be disparaged, but it's also by far the biggest fine, biggest criminal fine ever in antitrust or any other kind of case.
Do you know where that money goes? The international
and the tax credit,
isn't it?
U.S. Treasury.
U.S.?
Yeah.
Was that based on U.S., only on U.S. competition?
I think it would be based on the effects on the U.S. market. And say Europe or anybody else could bring a case if they chose to now. But the effects on their market. Worldwide? No. Which is probably good because if it was done through the WTO, this is no joke, I'm not just like cheap crap. That's a serious proposal that would be done through the WTO. And that'll take us a little bit too far afield.
How does the government use that money?
You know, they buy weapons, right? Whatever. And actually, maybe it takes some portion that goes to fund the Justice Department. I'm not sure that it should, because they're dramatically underfunded. In fact, their budgets are the same as they were in 1970, even though it's totally how much the
emergency. Do you think they'd have more incentive to actually investigate
the money? If it's just a modest source. But it should be. Another effect of all the mergers is you have diminished community outreach. Big companies tend not to care about reaching out to smaller communities, to rural communities, or poorer people. So the easy example for this is the banks. When the banks do